Good afternoon and welcome to the study for Thursday, March 28th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1622 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you again today for the study of the Crucible article. This day, it's a very long paragraph. I doubt we'll be doing it all, but it's chapter 9, paragraph 9. Yesterday we talked about Neferkerez, who's also called Nefelkerez, and also called him Amenemnisu. Amenemnisu is a modern name for the king mentioned by Manetho in Dynasty 21, who's also in a different order in Manetho's Dynasty 21, compared to the belief that we gathered after the Crucible article. In the Crucible article, we ignored the chronological significance of Amenemnisu, or Nefelkerez, assuming that his reign was included in the years of one of the other kings, such as Susen, for example, who reigned 46 years. But when we came to the new realization later in the Trojan War article by yours truly, we were forced by the current understanding of modern Egyptologists to try putting Nefelkerez as the successor of Smendes in Dynasty 21. And that would mean that we could not go any higher than 4 years for his final year, because that was what it was said in Manetho also. And what the modern scholars also believe is that Nefelkerez or Amenemnisu ruled for 4 years. 4 years, not no more than that. So when we were looking for the alignment with that feast on day five, it was a miracle that New Year's Day fell on precisely the fifth day of a lunar month in the year 1086, and Smendes being year 1, 1115, ruling for 26 years after that. 15 years takes us to 1100. 11 years remaining takes us to 1089, which is year 1 of, therefore, Amenemnisu. And 1086 is year 4, or 3 years after his year 1 of 1089. And then that pushed Susen down to 1085 for year 1 instead of 1088, which we had before. So it was not a big change, and it didn't affect many of the other kings. Also, with our having adopted after or during the Trojan War article the reign of 6 years for the fifth king of this dynasty, Osorkon the Elder, where we formerly had 8 years, and the net result was it only lowered the year one of Sayaman, whom Manetho calls Sinaches, by 1 year. So there was no real significant change in our chronology, but it was very important because it proved that we had the absolute chronology, since we had an alignment with the reign of Amenemnisu that was phenomenal. I mean, miraculous. I described it as being 6 times less likely to have occurred by chance, but I'm not sure where I got the number 6, because it's, for that to have occurred by chance certainly doesn't seem very auspicious or very promising for it to have occurred by chance. David slew Goliath in his youth. He lived at around the same time as this, you know, he was born in 1088, 1 year after the year one of Amenemnisu. And later, David was also famous for his prowess as a warrior in battle and for his faith. He used his wits in battle as well as his weapons and men. Later in his life, he commanded the murder of a man, which was the greatest sin of his life, perhaps, and proved that he was far from a perfect king, although many adored him. In his earlier days, he had refused to drink water brought to him by his men at the peril of their lives. Showing his respect for life and the strength of his principled faith. Because of his having killed men in war, he was not chosen to be the one to build Jehovah's house, called the temple. Instead, Solomon his son received dishonor, as we know. We have shown that the temple was aligned with the sunrise at Passover 1014 BCE, when the temple foundation was laid. That was in Joseph and On, one of the very early articles. When the temple foundation was laid, there was an alignment with the sun on the day of Passover. Also, recently, the Elah fortress was uncovered as a prime example of the Israelite strongholds of King David's time. David's later wife, Bathsheba, was the mother of his sons, both firstborn, who died shortly after birth, and Solomon. Earlier, it had been because of an adulterous relationship that David had with Bathsheba that David had committed the further sin of killing her husband by battlefield tactics. Her husband Uriah the Hittite died in battle by the plan of King David after the king had made Bathsheba pregnant. This shocking event in the life of King David brought with it a judgment from Jehovah when his son died quite young. Informed that his son had died, David comforted Bathsheba. King David's wife Bathsheba later bore a new son, Solomon. Solomon was loved by Jehovah, so that he also named him Jedidiah. Mr. Albert Barnes, 1798 to 1870, that was when he lived, in Notes on the Bible, puts Egyptian Pharaoh Shishak as contemporary with King Solomon of Israel in 980. When he says Pharaoh Shishak ascends, or alternatively, he gives it as 983 BCE, to the throne in Egypt, the first such date for Pharaoh Shishak, which puts him as ruling nearly with King Rehoboam, David's grandson. This precedent is crucial to absolute Egyptian chronology. Shishak's rule provides the basis for virtually all of the Egyptian chronologies in this time period, because he came up and attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, so correlating Egypt to Israel as to rule. Shishak has been identified as Egyptian pharaoh Shishak I based on chronological, historical, and linguistic grounds since the early decipherment of Egyptian hieroglyphs from explicit records of Pharaoh Shishak's Canaanite campaign. The Egyptian name Shishak equates to Hebrew Shishak. Shishak is called Sesostris by Herodotus. Africanus dubs him Sesonkis, and yet again Eusebius has Sesenkosis. There are at least three individual artifacts related to Shishak's campaign in Canaan, confirming it as of record. One, the victory relief of Shishak I at Amun Temple Karnak, Egypt. Two, Megiddo Stela fragment of Shishak I, Oriental Institute, Chicago. A fragment of a stela found at Megiddo in northern Israel, evidently the site of Egyptian victory and dominion. It preserves only Shoshank's name. He's also called Shoshank, with both nomen and prenomen. The names Shishak and Shoshank are interchangeable. The birth name and throne name, along with a few epithets. There's an error there, I see. No, it's not. It's not an error. Okay. I could modify the brackets to make it less like an error, but his nomen and prenomen are all that are preserved in that fragment from Megiddo. And three, a stela found in Hall K of the Temple at Karnak, which tells of skirmishes on the Nile Delta's eastern borders, a possible provocation for the ensuing campaign. That was from the Center for Online Judaic Studies and Insight on the Scriptures. Some have said that Pharaoh Shishak captured the Ark of the Covenant, but 2 Chronicles 12 and 9 says nothing of it. So let's conclude our study for now on this day for the Crucible article, and perhaps come back to it if we have time at the end, because there's a lot more to study here. But I want to say a little bit before we part, in case I forget to say it later, that we've adopted and we've noticed that there are two apparent year ones for Shoshank the First. Not just one, two. There are two dates, two year ones. But that's not a problem when we know and realize that during the reign of later kings, or previous kings rather, actually, perhaps also also later kings we know too, there were many cases of pharaohs co-ruling with other pharaohs, even though this is oftentimes denied by some archaeologists. For some unknown reason, they deny it. But even though we don't need any overlap between Susen and Amenemnisu, who's not named here on this list in the Crucible article, nor do we need any overlap between Susen I and his successor, Amenemope, nor with his successor, Osorkon the Elder, we do need an overlap between Saimon and his successor, Susen the Second. And therefore, it's not at all unusual for, or peculiar, it's not a problem at all for Susen to overlap with the reign, for his reign to overlap with the reign of his successor, Shoshank or Shishak. So it's not a problem. And then we have also, we noted that Osorkon the First, who was called Sira the First on the Ethiopian kings list, who was given 26 years on that list, that's not a problem either, if we believe that that 26 years could have been partly overlapped with his father or predecessor's reign, that of Shoshank the First, who died, we believe, in 959. 959, the death of Shoshank the First, is year one as king, 993, but also another year one was his sole rule commencing in 980. At that point, he could have begun to co-rule at some point later with his son Osorkon I, whose death was in 944, as we've been determining quite precisely, in agreement with the Bible, right? So 944. But if he reigned only 15 years, then 959 was when he began to rule, which would be the death of his father, which is perfectly fine. It consistently fits everything. But, and it's wonderful, but if 26 years was his reign, then 11 years onto that puts his year one as 970, which is about, is that right? Wait a minute. Yeah, about 10 years after his father began to rule by himself. So, yeah, so there are ways of easily accommodating the different numbers that we've obtained here. We're going to give some evidence later about the 993 date. Now for the study, let's go to, first of all, it's time for our daily proverb, little children. Proverbs 14 and 16 for today says, a wise man reveres and departs from a wrong. A fool rages on and in hope lingers long. That's today's proverb. Right, revering being another word for fear, actually. Just like the fear of Jehovah is reverence for Jehovah. A wise man reveres and departs from a wrong. A fool rages on and in hope lingers long. that's the end of our proverb for today. Second Chronicles 18. We didn't finish reading this, so I was going to read the part we didn't read yesterday and see if we can continue on, because it's a short chapter for today, chapter 19. Then then the king of Israel, and in verse 28 actually, and the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat the king of Judah proceeded to go up to Ramoth Gilead. The king of Israel now said to Jehoshaphat, "There will be a disguising," this is what Ahab said, "and entering into the battle for me, but you, for your part, put on your garments." Accordingly, the king of Israel disguised himself, after which they entered into the battle. As for the king of Syria, he had commanded the chiefs of the chariots that were his, saying, "You must fight." This was their opponent. "Neither with the small, nor with the great, but with the king of Israel alone." So their enemy was going to attempt to kill the king of Israel. And it came about that as soon as the chiefs of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, because Ahab was in disguise, and he was the king of Israel, they for their part said to themselves about Jehoshaphat, "It is the king of Israel." So they turned around against him to fight, and Jehoshaphat began to cry for aid, and Jehovah himself helped him, and God at once allured them away from him. And it came about that as soon as the chiefs of the chariots saw that it did not prove to be the king of Israel, they immediately came back from following him. And there was a man that bent the bow in his innocence, but he got to strike the king of Israel between the appendages and the coat of mail, so that he said to the charioteer, "Turn your hand around, and you must take me out from the camp, because I have been badly wounded." And the battle kept rising in intensity on that day, and the king of Israel, that is Ahab, himself, had to be kept in a standing position in the chariot facing the Syrians until the evening. And gradually he died at the time of the setting of the sun. That's the end of 2 Chronicles 18. Because they were in a fierce battle, they couldn't turn the chariot around. They couldn't give the king any medical attention or physical attention. We shouldn't call it medical attention, because medicine nowadays is too involved with certain practices that are not approved of, such as the use of drugs and so on, that are not approved by Jehovah. So, but I guess the word medical, we'll have to avoid it in the future. We'll have to find a good substitute. But we have physicians. That's a good word, I suppose. He wasn't able to receive any physical treatment for his wounds. He died. Ahab did. And Yahweh had saved the life of the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat. Micah chapter 5. "At this time you make cuttings upon yourself, O daughter of an invasion." That was something that Jehovah did not approve of either, the cuttings. But they did that to afflict themselves at certain times, the unfaithful Israelites. "O daughter of an invasion, a siege he has laid against us." This is a prophecy by Micah, chapter 5, verse 1. "With the rod they will strike upon the cheek the judge of Israel." We know that foretold how Jesus would be struck upon the cheek, because he was also the judge of Israel later, in a much grander sense, of course. But the later king of Israel, Zedekiah, who ruled quite a bit after the time of Micah, who prophesied no later than the time of King Hezekiah, 725 to 696 was the reign of Hezekiah, whereas Zedekiah he ruled from 597 to 587 BCE. But it foretells what happened to Zedekiah, because he was struck when Nebuchadnezzar came against Jerusalem in the siege of 587, that time period. The siege lasted from early in 588 to the middle of 587 BCE. And you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, this is a famous prophecy from Micah 5 and 2, as Adam Clark describes it, a famous prophecy. And you, O Bethlehem, also, he talks about it in his commentary on Matthew chapter 2, verse 6. So you may wish to refer to that. But this is, I'm trying to see where he talks about it as famous. Maybe in the earlier discussion here. Right, a most famous prediction, he says, concerning the birthplace of the Messiah. Micah 5 and 2. And you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, the one too little to get to be among the thousands of Judah. Or one translation he gives for that is, are you not too little among the thousands of Judah? Too insignificant among the thousands of Judah. From you there will come out to me the one who is to become ruler in Israel, whose origin is from early times, from the days of time indefinite. And that would be the days of time indefinite from Proverbs 8 and 22. Jehovah himself produced me as the beginning of his way, the earliest of his achievements of long ago. And also Colossians 1 and 15, he is the firstborn of all creation. John 1 and 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. And Micah, verse 3 of chapter 5. Therefore he will give them up until the time that she who is giving birth actually gives birth. And the rest of his brothers will return to the sons of Israel. And he will certainly stand and do shepherding in the strength of Jehovah, in the superiority of the name of Jehovah his God. Referring prophetically to the Messiah. And they will certainly keep dwelling, for now he will be as great as far as the ends. He will be great. I don't know why I said as great. He will be great as far as the ends of the earth. And this one must become peace. As for the Assyrian, when he comes into our land, which we know they did when they conquered Samaria, captured Samaria in BCE 719, and when he treads upon our dwelling towers, I mean, we're very confident in our dates because everything fits in our chronology and everything is interdependent. So we're fairly confident about our dates to a degree where we want to keep reasserting them to remind ourselves, because the world constantly has different dates for these events. We shall also have to raise up against him seven shepherds. Yes, eight dukes of mankind. Some understand, according to Adam Clark, this prophecy of seven or eight dukes, seven shepherds, eight dukes, as referring to Antiochus and the seven famous Maccabees and their eight royal successors from Aristobulus to Antigonus. And he says it is not impossible that these people may be also intended. Right, because we have often had occasion to remark that a prophecy of the Old Testament scriptures has frequently more than one aspect. That's what Clark says. And they will actually shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, these seven shepherds, eight dukes of mankind, and the land of Nimrod, verse 6, in its entrances. They will shepherd the land of Nimrod in its entrances. That's the same as the land of Assyria. And he will certainly bring about deliverance from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and when he treads upon our territory. And the remaining ones of, that is, whoever this person is who's going to deliver the Israelites from the Assyrians. Right? Although it refers prophetically to Jesus delivering spiritual Israel from their slavery to whoever represents the Assyrians in a figurative sense. And the remaining ones of Jacob must become in the midst of many peoples like dew from Jehovah. like copious showers upon vegetation, that does not hope for man or wait for the sons of earthling man. And the remaining ones of Jacob must become, among the nations, in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of a forest, like a maned young lion among droves of sheep, which, when it actually passes through, certainly both tramples down and tears in pieces. And there is no deliverer. Your hand will be high above your adversaries, and all enemies of yours will be cut off. And it must occur in that day is the utterance of Yahweh, that I will cut off your horses from the midst of you, and destroy your chariots. And I will cut off the cities of your land, and tear down all your fortified places. In other words, warfare will be done away with for Jehovah's people. And I will cut off, verse 12, sorceries out of your hand. So no drugs and no practicers of magic will you continue to have. And I will cut off your graven images and your pillars, verse 13, from the midst of you. And you will no more bow down to the work of your hands. Verse 14, and I will uproot your sacred poles from the midst of you. Something we saw that Jehoshaphat did in our study in Chronicles today, interestingly. And annihilate your cities. But of course, Jehoshaphat lived long before the time of Micah. And in anger and in rage, I will execute vengeance upon the nations that have not obeyed. Right, because even though there were obedient kings like Jehoshaphat, subsequent kings such as Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, was not faithful at all. And he brought a lot of false worship into the promised land, which was disgraceful and something that was detested greatly by Jehovah. And in anger and in rage, verse 15, Micah chapter 5 concludes, I will execute vengeance upon the nations that have not obeyed, as I just read. And that's the end of Micah chapter 5. The nations, interestingly, are called heathens. That's the definition of what a heathen is. Is any nation that is not, if you look at the King James Version, and I will execute vengeance in anger and fury upon the heathen. The heathen, such as they have not heard. All nations are considered heathen in the Bible. That was the definition of the word heathen. It just meant anyone who is not Jewish. That's what it meant. That's what it means. They didn't have faith in Jehovah, in Yahweh. That necessitated that they be defined as heathen. Just the definition of the word. And we're not done, but that's good. We got the reading done. So maybe we can talk a little more now, read a little more from this remarkable paragraph 9, which is so long. Right, so we talked about the evidence for Shishak being Shishak. And King Solomon had married a daughter of a pharaoh of Egypt, and the pharaoh was named Senachis. In Mr. Barnes' notes, of course, today he's called Simon. But Mr. Barnes writes, it must have been a predecessor of Shishak or Shishak, who, as he's also called, Shishak, who invaded Judea more than 40 years later. And probabilities are in favor. Not of Susen II, the last king of Manetho's 21st dynasty, but of, okay, right, Sennachis, the predecessor of Susen. This, the Tanite dynasty, had become very weak, especially toward its close. So this is before the invasion of Shishak, of course. He's talking about 40 years after some other event. The Tanite dynasty had become very weak, especially toward its close, from where we may conceive how gladly it would ally itself with the powerful house of David. The Jews were not forbidden to marry foreign wives if they became proselytes, as Solomon is not blamed for this marriage either here or in 1 Kings 11, and as the idol temples which he allowed to be built in 1 Kings 11, 5-7, were in no case dedicated to Egyptian deities. So it is to be presumed that his Egyptian wife adopted her husband's religion. Albert Barnes' Notes on the Bible, 1 Kings 3 and 1. Sennacherib is the second king prior to Shishak the First, or Shashak. Corresponding to Pharaoh Sennacherib in Africanus, 9 years, and to Pharaoh Sennacherib in Eusebius, spelled a bit differently, 9 years, these being found in our modern day, corresponding to Pharaoh Cyamun. It is wise to be cautious about the identification of this Pharaoh Cyamun as the father of Solomon's bride, even when we note that Mr. Kenneth Kitchen believed Cyamun as having conquered the town of Gezer, and according to 1 Kings 9 and 16, presented it to his daughter, Solomon's wife, in parting. That's from 1 Kings 9 and 16. The work of archaeologists has not always proceeded in the most scientific way, as is revealed by scientific methods. Radiocarbon dating, for example, has helped greatly in the confirmation for the dating of the kings in ancient Egypt. Radiocarbon testing with its variable results is worthless without chronological evidence to confirm its correctness. There's a lot of variation in radiocarbon results, a lot of scatter in the data, a lot of unpredictability in radiocarbon. That's what that's saying. Therefore, it's worthless without any chronological information. Egyptian chronology, well, it is the best of the available histories of the nations outside of Israel, or the heathens, we could say the heathens, is inferior to the Bible by its frequent errors and is far from perfect. Conclusions are drawn from considerations not fully given, and in the time of King David, the scope is unsatisfactory. That is, the conventional Egyptian chronology is fallible. As Egypt becomes an iron furnace, so do we use an Egyptian chronology as the fire which heats our crucible of truths. As Egypt becomes an iron furnace, as flames dance in a fire's midst, so does that chronology of Egyptian pharaohs continue to change and play as light. This is a deceptive light which was ultimately unreliable. That's enough for today's reading. In the work of a proponent of a scientific chronology, Mr. Girard Gertu, we get a different positioning of the pharaohs of Egypt in an unusual and thus inspiring state. After my recent discovery of his work, we begin to inquire into specific lunar synchronisms within the Egyptian fire. And it's not a problem when we have conflicting ideas. Just like in the Bible, there are conflicting ideas. You know, God is love. Love is not jealous. God is a jealous God. They seem to conflict, but of course there are different kinds of jealousy, and there are ways of understanding these things, just like there are ways of understanding conflicts in chronology. And today's study and video is concluded now. It's March 28th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 16:55 hours Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now.